the clerics. She was the wealthiest and the most powerful organization. She claimed to be of that divine origin. But very clearly, she was made out of very human material, and I am talking about people now. The clerics who were of these people were of two kinds. The secular clergy, and here we're going to get into a little bit of what you were asking about before, Tom, but not as much as we will later on, too, so stick with me. Tom had asked me a question about the breakdown of the clergy, and I put him off, and I wanted him to know that I knew I was putting him off, and I will come back to it. But this is beginning to get at it. The clerics were of two kinds, the secular clergy, the priests and the bishops, who claimed to be the pastors or the shepherds of the flock. Then the regular clergy, the monks and the mendicant friars, who lived by special rules, free from the responsibility having to work to earn a living in order to live a life of prayer and a wandering ministry. And I said to the class before what I want to say to the rest of you, if you want a sort of a caricature of this, then read Robin Hood. Because that was written for these times and from these times. And you know the characters in the story of Robin Hood. That's a pretty good description, even historically speaking, of what was going on there. These wandering friars, mendicants. The men of the mendicant orders, which ultimately proved to be part of the destruction of the Church of Rome, because they received their authority directly from Rome, and when they would come into the jurisdiction of another one of these church officers, they didn't another one of the bishops or even the cardinals of another part of the world, they didn't owe any allegiance to the one in whose land, in whose country, in whose jurisdiction they were operating. And the people, of course, flocked to these traveling monks. Because it was a known fact that it was much easier to confess to a person who wasn't going to be there very long than to confess with somebody who was going to be there to continue to oversee the flock. And so these people earned a lot more money than those who were living right there and who could help to oversee over a period of time. These mendicant friars lived by special rules. They were free of the responsibilities for working for a living, to live a life of prayer and a wandering ministry. And perhaps the clerical immorality and the sale of the church offices and the other abuses was not as rampant in the 1500s. Perhaps it was just better known and more visible. The church, and especially the Vatican, the papacy in Rome, had been at its height from 1150 to 1200. But it had drifted from bad to worse, and was so large, and the inertia and the trends that controlled it were so strong that it did not seem to be able to reform itself. And you need to know that there were popes who protested the bad developments in that church. And they tried to bring about reforms, but they were overwhelmed. We talk about the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. The bureaucracy in Rome was far greater and worse in many ways. A man was usually not elected pope until he was 70 or 80 years old, and then he only lived a few years. And those who were the resident bureaucracy knew how to manipulate and control in spite of anything he wanted to do. And there were some good popes who wanted to bring about a reform. But according to their own records, this doesn't have anything to do with anyone looking in from outside. This has to do with their own records. And we'll see some more of that when we get into the history of the Church of Rome. Hay Fleming has written a beautiful history on the Reformation of Scotland, in which he's quoting not from what reformers or Protestants are saying, but he's quoting about the laments that are being made by the clergy and the others all the way up to Rome itself of the corruptions in the church in Rome, in Scotland. And this will be, when we come to the point of the things leading up to the Reformation, we will talk more about that. But there were those in the church who wanted to see reform. And there were so many of the others who were living off the church that they were not able to bring that about. The church had lost the administrative efficiency and the centralization that it had had in the 11 and 12 and 1300s. The three key powers of the popes in the 11 and 12 and 1300s had also been eroded. The powers of appointment, the powers of taxation, the powers of jurisdiction, and the review of appeals. These things were being resisted and changed. Kings and emperors and lords and nobles demanded a stronger hand in all of the appointments to all of the church offices under their jurisdiction. And they were very jealous and careful about the monies that were leaving their jurisdiction to go down to the Vatican. And they were curtailing those cases that were being appealed to Rome. They were finding one way or another ways of prohibiting people from going to Rome to appeal their court cases. In 1516, Francis I of France made a deal with the Pope Leo X, which gave him the same powers of appointment that Ferdinand and Isabella already had for Spain. In other words, one country would look over here and see that this country had a particular deal going with the Vatican, and then they'd say, hey, we want the same thing. And this was snowballing. In England, Pope's powers were limited even earlier, but the kings let it go for other reasons. And then, after Cardinal Wolsey had built up a real empire or a dictatorship over England for Henry VIII, the royal family took it all over as the base or the model for their own English church. That's what I was telling a little bit earlier about how Henry had built up the case for the Pope, and then when the Pope wouldn't give him his divorce, he simply bumped the Pope out of his shoes, and he himself stepped into those shoes and became, as many said, the Pope of the Anglican Church. By 1517, the Pope's power to appoint and to tax and to judge was severely curtailed in nations which were otherwise clearly Catholic: France, Spain, and England. The Pope no longer had the authority and the power that he had had. But Germany was different. There was no secular power strong enough to stand up to the Pope in Germany. The great bishops of Germany were princes or electors. They were independent of the Pope, and they were politically wealthy. The Pope drew enforced income from Germany, and the emperor just split that income with the Pope. It went through the hands of the emperor. Now, if any of you happen to see some relationship between what was going on here in the 1500s and some things that are going on in the donation system in Washington, D.C., you are right. And the question is, why can't we learn? That's not a church situation there, but as money comes in, it doesn't all go into the public coffers. And the king had the money being given to him, and then he just split with the Pope. There was a rising unrest, though, and a resentment, an increasing resentment. The lid was on, and it was all coming to a boil, because the German peasants, who were at the very bottom of all of this, they were peasants in the worst sense of the word, and Luther's father was one of them. They were peasants, and they were beginning to react and to resent these things that were imposed upon them. Another cause of weakness in the church: many bishops had lost control of the priests in their parish. Those monastic orders held directly from the Pope himself. And most bishops were just nobles who received the income but really didn't pass to the flock. The gift of a bishopric was a good way for a lord to provide a younger son, or a king to provide for a bastard child, or for bishops and cardinals to provide for bastard children. And we'll find a lot of that taking place in Britain. You find the roles, and this is why I like Hay Fleming's book, because he has simply copied those roles at where a priest, a cardinal, a bishop is wanting to legitimate his son. Well, how do you have a son? And that had to go into the records. And many bishops had several bishoprics priests and other parish clergy had to get along however they could. And they were ignorant and they were immoral. There was a generally reforming, a man who was a genuinely reforming bishop was, and there were those, as I said before, there were popes who really wanted to see this cleaned up. And there were many bishops who wanted to see this cleaned up. And so a bishop who wanted to see it cleaned up would get a letter of authority directly from Rome. But when he went into the monasteries or the convents, his very life was at stake. And there are records of when some of those men who were trying to see that cleaned up were killed. If reform was to come, it needed to come from the Pope. But in the 1500s, Alexander VI, in the year 1500, was probably one of the worst and most immoral popes of all. He was only interested in carving out a kingdom for himself and his family there in Italy. Now came the indulgences. Financial conditions in the Vatican in the early 1500s were just one step away from bankruptcy. The Vatican was expensive, defending papal states, supporting a huge, lavish administration, necessity to support crusades against the Turks. And at first, the money was squeezed out of the higher clergy, simony, the sale of those spiritual offices, those clerical offices. But the higher clergy put the squeeze on people. Rents were raised, fees for burials. The probate of wills became a source of income for the Vatican. A man would die, and we'll probably hear some of this later on when we get into that, and this is well documented over and over again. A man would die, and the priest would go in, and they'd have maybe two cows, and he would take one, or they had one cow, and he would take that, leaving the widow and the children without any. And he was able to take for the privilege of burying the person. He was able to take almost whatever he wanted. Fees for burial were increased. The idea of indulgences and contributions began. If a person truly repentant, repentance was forthcoming as a temporal penalty for sin, so indulgences were granted to people. Going on a crusade to fight the Turks would mean that a man could be excused for almost any sin. Going on a pilgrimage to Rome, a man could be excused from almost any sin. For those in purgatory, for those who wanted to commit a sin, they could buy an indulgence before they committed it. The idea of an indulgence to secure forgiveness for the living, but then came the idea of an indulgence to secure forgiveness for those who had already died and were in purgatory. And in the 1400s, the dogma was established of a reservoir of merits to be dispensed by the Pope to all those who would simply buy the indulgences. That came, you see, in the 1400s. Now, I'm beginning to talk about the causes leading up to the Reformation. The Church was selling the very means of salvation in order to raise money for largely secular purposes. So questions began to proliferate. Was the Pope necessary? Could we exist? Could we be a church without a Pope? They had been told that that was not possible. No Pope, no church. There has to be a Pope. Was a mediating priesthood necessary? Is it possible to get my sins forgiven without having to go to a person who would simply say after the confession, Ego te absolvo, I forgive you. And are all the sacraments essential to salvation? And those of you who saw the film of Wycliffe know that these were things that were coming up again and again in his life. Before Luther, there had been four hopes for reform in the church. Saintly individuals to set an example. Savonarola in Florence in 1498. He was an example of this, Savonarola. And there were many godly men in the church who were grieved to tears as they saw these things developing. Savonarola was one of these. Saintly individuals in the church, that was one possibility of hope. Institutional activity, councils, conciliar activities. the Council of Constance, 1414 to 1418, the Council of Basel, 1431 to 1449, clipping the wings of the Pope and the papacy and the Vatican. Third, secular rulers, kings such as Ferdinand and Isabella, who backed Cardinal Zinis. Wherever there was a godly, strong ruler, it was possible that these abuses in the church could be cleaned up. But wherever there's a weak, unprincipled ruler, as in Germany, just didn't seem to be much hope. It was often one step forward and two steps back. But fourth was Christian humanism. This was some possibility, the new learning that this would save the church. Get back to the writing of Socrates. The original language is the Old and New Testament. That would clean it all up by academic study, translations of the Bible into the common language of the people. Sir Thomas More in England, Erasmus in Rotterdam and Basel, the king of the humanists. These were hopes that they had for the reformation of the church. And I just can't overemphasize the fact that there were people in the church who were sick about what they saw taking place. But they did not seem to know how these things could be changed. I'd like to go on to the 17 circumstances in the church just prior to the Reformation. They had a way of blowing the whistle on me down there and saying, hey, we need to make a break. can you go out and back in 10 minutes, please? Could you try that? And we'll be right ready to go here, and I think we can finish this next one on Reformation history, 17 circumstances in the church. Hi.
I just got a message from Bud Wilson this evening about
yes.
Dr. Ware.
His son, Matthew.
How old is Matthew?
I think he's... Heather, did we hear how old Matthew Ware was? Seven. Was he 12 or 17? How much? I don't know what the bell is or what the whistle is or what the what is, but I'm begging your indulgence. How about that word? How about that word? You caught me. I'd like to ask that we would do something else tonight. I want you to see something of what we will be doing from time to time in the whole class. And so instead of going into the 17 circumstances of the church prior to the Reformation, which is what I had originally planned to do, I'm going to be asking that we would pick that up first thing next week. And tonight, I want you to hear Dr. John Gerstner on Martin Luther. And I think this will be a change of pace. I know I've been lecturing since 8 o'clock this morning, and I kind of think my voice can get tired and can probably get a little bit boring. I'm really impressed with your alertness. I haven't seen anybody go to sleep. I have seen people continuing to take notes. I think a lot of that is because of the overhead here, and I surely am thankful for this overhead. These are notes that I've written myself, and Heather, bless her heart, has had to not only hear them now, but she has had to read them. You talk about persecution, having to read these things. One of the qualifications for becoming my secretary used to be that you had to be a Chinese handwriting expert. And Heather has learned to do that. And she's responsible for making it easier for you to get these facts out in front of you. However, the tape that you're going to hear now does not have any outline. So you'll have to take these cold turkey, as it were, taking notes as you go along. We may have time for a little bit of discussion afterwards, but I don't think so. I do want you to hear Dr. John Gerstner, whom I still consider to be the ranking theologian of the past generation. He's died just a few years ago. And we had an arrangement worked out whereby he would be coming out here every other year or so to teach in this class. He was out here, I think, twice, and then the Lord took him. But he didn't take his videos, and so we can still hear from him. And this is Dr. John Gerstner, Ed, do you know how to punch that thing on? I don't know that I do. Please, could you? and we'll, if you can pull out this light up here.
Vignettes from the standpoint of theology. I don't give you any kind of rounded picture, which you can get from many biographies which have been written about each of these eminently influential theologians. But Martin Luther was a German miner's son, born in Eisleben, Germany, where he later on died, and where his memorial exists to this day. He had an unusual education for a miner's son, because this particular miner didn't want his son to remain a miner, but to become a lawyer. And so he did take the gymnasium, the kind of training that the Germans usually make for their people who are going on to more academically strenuous exercises and professional activities. We'll gloss over that as we come to what actually persuaded him to be a monk. And that was a series of experiences that came to a climax and a stroke of lightning, which took a friend of his but spared him and convinced him that he ought to become a candidate for the priesthood. And that he did in Erfurt, Germany. And in 1505, he began training. In 1507, he was ordained as a priest in the Augustinian order, and in close consultation with his counselor, Staupitz, he began to feel out the way through the medieval scholastic theological synthesis, and was having deep trouble with it. I think during that period, as he becomes a doctor and then becomes a teacher in Wittenberg, Germany, that what we ought to notice especially as contributory to the formation of this great reformer is that in 1509, he met Augustine, as that seems to be the year in which he really discovered that great saint of the church who really up until that time was the major theologian of the Catholic, I keep reminding you, that is not the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church came into existence in 1564 when it officially repudiated the Reformation and adhered to the accumulated heresies of the Middle Ages and actually rejected the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Maybe I better take a moment on that. We're not lecturing on Romanism directly, but it comes sharply into focus in this 16th century, where we're concerned with Martin Luther and John Calvin. But let me explain here, before I go further with the story of Martin Luther himself, that during, we mentioned with respect to Augustine, a heavy emphasis on the Catholic Church and the importance of recognizing that the Church is Catholicae, or universal, and cannot be restricted as the Donatists were doing it, to a certain section of North Africa or to a certain area which is considered Orthodox. The universality of the church must be understood. And in that sense, Augustine was a very strong Catholic. And we have to watch, and just in terms of the use of language, you read the word Catholic in a newspaper today, you invariably think of Roman Catholic. It's a tribute to Roman Catholicism PR efficiency that they have monopolized that word. Strictly speaking, Roman Catholic is a contradiction in terms. This means universal and this means specific. The only person who can be Catholic is a person who recognizes the existence of the church. There are many, many places wherever Jesus Christ is satisfactorily confessed. It can't be restricted to any one denomination unless one can prove that that denomination alone on the face of the earth proclaims the essential Christian doctrine. So for a church actually to maintain that it is Roman Catholic is to contradict itself. Can't possibly say that this church, even if you believed it were evangelical, even if you believe it's a church, and so on. You can't possibly believe it's the only church that Roman Catholic constitutes a non-contradiction. But the reason, as I say, Augustine was so concerned about Catholicity was that point. And we noticed even when we looked at Thomas Aquinas, though his dedication to Rome was deeper than Augustine's, Both of them were recognizing Rome because they did accept the Episcopal form of government as the proper head of the church in the Episcopal pattern, but they were not recognizing, and none of them was stating that the Pope of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, was infallible, or that his approval was essential to a person being saved. That type of thing did not become official, that he was infallible, as I say, until 1870. So this Catholicity that you have is really denied for the first time at the Council of Trent, where they did, first of all, affirm an authority for the magisterium there that had shaped these doctrines at the Council of Trent, and did insist that you were anathema if you didn't believe all of their particular doctrines. And among others, they rejected the doctrine of justification by faith alone very, very vigorously. Not altogether unambiguously, but very vigorously nevertheless. And if this doctrine is, as Martin Luther is going to say, and all of the reformers are going to agree, and I think everybody listening to these tapes will also acknowledge, if this is absolutely indispensable to the way of salvation, then any church which categorically and dogmatically and definitively rejects it ceases to be a Christian church. I repeat, if anybody denied that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, he would cease to be a Christian. Rome does not do that. If anybody denied the Trinity, you couldn't possibly maintain he was a Christian. But if anyone denied the vicarious atonement of Jesus Christ, the basis of salvation is taken away. Again, Rome does not deny that. But what's crucial in the 16th century and came to a more articulate head than at any time in the history of the church was that the way the sacrifice of the incarnate Son of God comes savingly to the soul is by faith alone. If that be true, and all that Christ is and all that Christ did becomes efficacious for the individual sinner by that way and that way alone, as Martin Luther was maintaining and Calvin and so on, then the church which denied that, no matter how much truth it had, no matter how much it led up to that, was denying what's absolutely essential to the Christian religion. I believe that's what happened at Rome. That's the reason I call 1564, which is the death of John Calvin, also the death of the Roman Catholic Church. It ceases to be a Catholic Church after that particular time, not just because of the contradiction in terms here, but because it has rejected what is indispensable to salvation and has affirmed what would be indispensable to damnation, that is, the insistence on accepting certain doctrines about the sacrament, the number of them, and matters like that as well. So it's a doubly fatal decision there. But to get back now to Martin Luther and his own developments here, 1509, he becomes aware of Augustine, and he is struggling with this matter of a decadent papacy. According to the story his son tells, his son Paul, we don't know whether it was an authentic one or not, but that when his father visited Rome, he, on climbing up the Scala Sancta on his knees, became fully aware of the fact that justification was by faith alone. Up until that time, he had fancied that his acceptance with God was by this diligent asceticism that he was practicing as an Augustinian monk, and he was very severe in his self-discipline and very conformist to what he felt was true. But he was really, even though he believed in Jesus Christ, he was really counting on his own performances as an indispensable, meritorious basis, along with Christ's work, for his salvation. According to his son, it was while visiting Rome and actually climbing the steps on his knees that he realized that and got up from his knees and walked down the steps. And if that be so, that is the birth of evangelicalism, Protestantism, the Reformation in 1511. But what nobody seems to know, and there's a vast literature on Martin Luther. He's such a crucial figure in the history of the world that everybody everybody has investigated every aspect of his life down to the last manuscript and so on, but the general tendency is to assume that it was in 1513 that he had his famous Turm Erlebnis, tower experience. That in his study, what he had been teaching in the Bible as a lecturer and so on, came home to him in evangelical experience. And he realized that salvation was by grace alone, even then. You can't prove that. But when we come to what is usually considered the Reformation Day, October 31st, 1517, you have a really insignificant episode made into the crux of the Reformation because of what happened in connection with it. You see, if he did walk down the Sola Scripta Sancta on his feet, that would show that the man was convinced of evangelicalism long before that. If it was 1513 that he realized this, then that's when the Reformation was born. But actually, these famous 95 theses that he posted on the Wittenberg chapel door as an academic challenge to anybody who would debate him was occasioned by this very crass solicitor, Tetzel, who was raising money by offering indulgence and was telling the people that when the money clinks, when the money rings in the coffers there, that some soul springs out of purgatory. It was that crass way of selling salvation to people who were suffering the torments of the damned in purgatory that aroused this Augustinian monk to the vigorous protest. But if you actually read the 95 theses, you would never know that the man was evangelically awake. He probably was before this, but you don't get justification by faith alone in those theses. What you do get is a vigorous opposition to the way in which Rome was actually propagating her theology in this monk Tetzel. But because this, which he thought when he posted these theses, would be simply an academic debate, somebody would take up his challenge, somebody, Tetzel or somebody else, would defend that vigorous, effective way of promoting the well-being of the church by raising money as rapidly as possible, and it would just pass off as an academic exercise. But as a matter of fact, it woke all Europe. Karl Barth in the 20th century said he started to preach on the book of Romans, and it was like a blind man reaching out and pulling down a bell rope which woke all of Europe. And certain things that surprise people, even when they're doing it. And Martin Luther was greatly surprised when this set of challenges of an academic character actually led to the real Reformation awakening. What I'm trying to say here is the real awakening of Luther appears to have taken place earlier. It was this objection to a very abusive way of propagating Roman dogma, which actually started the set of events which did themselves lead ultimately to Martin Luther's full-scale declaration of the Reformation principle. But that's the way it does happen. Now, after he posts those theses and angers Rome by his statement, the next episode is when he is called to Heidelberg to give an account of himself to his own order. Here is a rather rash monk up there in Wittenberg who's embarrassing his whole order by these drastic statements here, and he is called to give an account. Now, one of the things that happens, one of the incidental things, that Martin Bucer is there, and he is actually persuaded of evangelical principles just listening to Luther defend himself before his own order. But as far as Luther is concerned, the most significant thing that happens at this examination of him by his own order in the spring of 1518 is that he maintains against Thomas Aquinas now, who had taken the position under the influence of Albertus Magnus, that Aristotle was essential to being a good theologian. Luther broke with that drastically And in his examination here at Heidelberg, he actually said the opposite. That to be a good theologian, you have to do so sine Aristotle, without Aristotle. You couldn't have Aristotle as a part of your thought. I think he made a mistake there myself, but I think I understand what he means. He feels, Pope John the 23rd once said, I'm in a bag here, referring to Rome. I think that Luther felt he was in a bag with the systematic theology that had come down to him from the Middle Ages, even though it was modified somewhat by other theologians after Aquinas. He felt, let me see if I can get this over, Martin Luther felt that that theology wasn't saving him, that the most rigorous conformity to it was leaving him a very anxious and at many times terrified young monk. And though he didn't know what was wrong with it, but it was inextricably tied up with Aristotle and that synthesis which Aquinas had developed in the 13th century, and he felt somehow it was vague. I don't think he understood quite what he was doing, but he just sensed there was something wrong with that, and the only way to get out of this bag, to break from these chains, was to get away from that synthesis and from Aristotle himself. Now, the next episode took place in the fall of 1518 at Augsburg, where he was called upon. As I said to you at the beginning here, his life and his doctrine are almost inseparably connected. One just follows right out of the other. And what you see as I'm tracing this here is the formation of a Reformation theologian and the articulation of it, almost as if it's as surprising to Luther as it is to those who watch the events. But Cardinal Cajetan was sent by the Pope to check on this troublesome monk, Martin Luther, that Leo didn't want to be bothered with, and he knew that Cajetan was an expert in Thomistic theology, and he ought to be able to put down this wild boar in the vineyard. That's the way Luther was looked at at first, a wild boar, a bull in a china shop, a person who just didn't understand the fine points of theology and was causing all sorts of trouble to simple-minded Germans and such things as that. So we'll send an expert. This examination by his own order didn't seem to quiet him. So we'll send an expert on Thomistic theology, Cardinal Cajetan, to deal with him. Now, Luther goes to Augsburg for a couple days of conference with Cajetan. He's running scared. He's in real danger now. He knows what's happened to heretics before, and he could very well be apprehended and executed. So there's a good deal of tension here at this particular point, but one thing becomes clear at this particular conference. Cajetan is not only a Thomistic theologian, but he is a Roman authoritarian championing the rights of the Pope. And in the conference between the two, Martin Luther is recognizing that he's going to break with the Pope if necessary. Remember, the Pope is the head of the Roman Church at this time. The center of operations is Rome, and he is the top of the hierarchy there. That's all granted. And no notion of his infallibility or any dogma such as that or that's been officially declared as a dogma. But there's no question, on the other hand, that the Roman Catholic Church's head is the Pope at Rome, and rebelliousness against him is an extremely serious offense. Some popes would say it's a fatal offense. If you are not subordinate to the Pope, you will be damned. There are popes who have said that through the ages. Pope Boniface VIII had already declared that against the King of France, and so on. But the point is that it's not yet a dogma that that is the case, though there is no question whatever that the Pope is the head of the Church. And when this dialogue takes place, you realize where Luther is. He's virtually saying to Cajetan, I am pleading in war. I don't think he understands all that's involved here. I hope he will, but at the same time, the Cajetan is saying to him that you just have to obey the authorities and so on. He himself is making it clear that though he would take the papacy if he could get the gospel, he is very much afraid that the papacy is a threat. And I think what you can say was realized by Martin Luther at this particular conference, this is 1518, excuse me, here, is that he's going to break with the Pope if necessary. That this principle that he has formed more or less clearly by now and so on is going to cause a break with the papacy, and he's prepared to have it if necessary. He doesn't think it's necessary at this stage. He still hopes, because he believes he's right, that the Pope will recognize he's right, correct the various injustices and abuses that have occurred, and that a peaceful reformation will take place. But the thing that's clear there is that he will break with the Pope if necessary. He hopes it's not necessary, and he doesn't think it's necessary at this particular time. This is 1519 is the time when he has the most crucial meeting of all, and that's the famous debate at Leipzig with Johannes Eck. Christianity Today had an interesting article on Eck just a few months ago. He was a very learned man and probably the ablest of the Roman Catholic disputants of his time. And in this debate, which went over several days, a thoroughgoing debate, each man fully equipped with his reference books and such things as that, no hurry about it, a thorough working out of the basic principles, I would say, if I were the judge on that occasion, based on what I know of the debate, Eck won it. Luther was proven wrong. Because up to this time, Luther, who had by this time broken in principle with him, and while no one person can be infallible, so as obedience to him be necessary to salvation, the church as a whole gathered together its official representatives at an ecclesiastical council, that could not err. And Eck proved to him that, as a matter of fact, Martin Luther believed, as Martin Luther did not realize before Eck proved it to him, that Martin Luther believed that even councils could err. And that the Council of Constantinople had when it had condemned him and executed him for heresy, and Luther comes out of this debate saying, "We are all Hussites." Meaning by that holding to what we consider evangelical truth, we will defy Pope and Council and die if necessary. Now, Eck won that debate, but it was done perhaps the most important single formation of the life of Martin Luther as a reformer. The next big thing to happen is the bull of the Pope, the bull of excommunication, which Luther, in a grand scene outside the city walls at Wittenberg, burned. Now it was perfectly clear that Luther was a heretic and that he was on his way to eternal damnation. Roman excommunication certainly meant your law. There was only one step left to be taken, and that was in 1520, April 17th and 18th, at the Diet or Parliament of Worms in southern Germany, where Luther, now an excommunicate, now under the indictment of his own church, is summoned before the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, an utterly devout Roman Catholic, thoroughly committed to the hierarchy and to the councils and so on, to give an account of himself with the understanding if he's found at fault, he is to be condemned by the civil arm, which has the power of execution. Now here, my time is almost up. Just let me get the crux of this before you, and then when we... because this is where it's here that Martin Luther is asked whether he believes in justification of the things he's written. He asks for a day to read all of his writings to make sure, and the next day he affirms that he does, and there comes that famous statement that it's not safe to violate conscience any. That's what Scripture teaches, rationally deduced from the Holy Scripture. This is the point at which Martin Luther, breaking now with the Pope, having broken with the councils as well, realizes everything depends on Martin Luther. Of all the solas, the sola scriptura and the sola fide and so on, here is the solo Luther right now, without whom there would not have been a Reformation. If he had not stood firm at that point, no matter what he had written, no matter what he had said, the fundamental principles of the Reformation, judging from external circumstances, would have perished with his own recantation. But thank God, he did not recant. at risk to his own life. He'd already condemned to eternal hell, and now he would almost certainly be executed by the Roman emperor. He stood firm for the principles that we hold absolutely essential to Christian salvation.
This is where we'll pick it up next week. How's that for ending with an anticipation of what is yet to come on the remainder of this from John Gerstner? I want to comment just a minute on a couple of things here. One is that this is current events. Catholics and Evangelicals in Action was a paper that was prepared by people such as Charles Colson. I can't think of the Roman Catholic. Somebody help me here. Teacher, theologian, who had joined him with him. What's the name? I can't hear.
Newhouse.
And Michael Horton was involved in that, and so are a number of other men. And some of the men that you know personally were directly involved in signing that paper. And there was such a reaction to that that some of the men actually took their names off that. Now, towards the close of this particular class, I want to show you a video where Dr. Gerstner is further debating this particular subject. That seemed to be settled until a matter of about 2 or 3 months ago, when the whole subject came up again and is now still before us. And Dr. Gerstner was saying then, and R.C. Sproul was saying then, and is saying now, that the Roman Catholic Church has not changed. As far as her doctrine is concerned, she has not changed from these findings of the Council of Trent. And I've heard him say many times, and I've seen him involved in some debate with theologians of the Roman Catholic Church, in which they're saying, but we have changed. And he's said many times, I have to spend as much time showing them that they have not changed. That's still the official doctrine, as it was in the Council of Trent. That's still the official doctrine of the church. And furthermore, there are certain actions in the church which says we cannot change and we will never change. And he has said many times, I have to spend as much time teaching them what the doctrines of their own church actually are, as I do then refuting those doctrines, such basic thing as salvation by faith alone, justification by faith alone. I have to spend as much time showing them what their own church teaches as I do refuting that doctrine then. And we'll get into a little bit more of that next time, and all I'm saying here now is that that is current events. John Gerstner is making a bit of an apology there about not teaching the biography of Martin Luther. And he doesn't teach history, he teaches the history of theology. These dates have to do with doctrinal developments. And that is a strong point of his. Don't blame him for that. Thank God for that. He's so sensitive to these high water marks, these dates in which the development of Luther's own thinking was concerned, was to be seen. And I'm confident with Dr. Gerstner that Martin Luther was amazed at the position that he was driven to, and that he did come to in that debate with Johannes Eck. And those of you who are in the medieval class saw the fact is that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and there was no one to hold accountable the position of the papacy. There was no one to hold accountable. He was totally accountable only to himself. The College of Cardinals in no way held him accountable. And so then it came to the place where there was an uprising in the church, and they began calling the councils. One of the reasons was for that was the fact that there were more than one person who was claiming to be Pope for various reasons. At one time, there were three. And so the question was then, who was the right one? And the councils were called in order to try to resolve that the church could be reformed in head and in body. Not only at the bottom of the grassroots level, but also at the very top. And the councils had a very strong influence, but that one council also did burn John Huss. And we look back on that today and we say that's not right, and the Catholic Church has tried to make that right. But the fact is that the doctrine that caused her to do what she did to him has never been changed from the Council of Trent days. It's still on the books. And after everything else is said and done, it's there. And John Gerstner and R.C. Sproul and a number of those other men like that have said that to say that there is change there when there is not change there is trivializing the very essence of the Reformation itself. And now we're being asked to reconsider that again. And some of the foremost men in the Reformed Church are doing that. He'll tell us in the next part of this tape about the Diet of Worms and about how Luther was rescued, at that time kidnapped in order to be rescued, and about how his life increased in witness and ministry from there on. This is important history, and we really do need to know this today. It's current events. Last time I taught this class up at Ottawa, I simply said, now it comes to the point where you're going to have to make the decision. And so I played the video of Dr. Gerstner, in which he is debating the subject of the recent papers, Catholics and Evangelicals working together. And he was naming names and identifying people and telling what their positions were, and then comparing that to the findings and statements of the Council of Trent. So we'll look forward to doing that again. Thank you for being here. If there's anything we can help with, as I say, call Michael or Heather, and they'll have answers. I'll try the best I can, and I don't mean to be putting it off on them. Any questions that you have about the tour coming up, I want you to meet David Quigley, Andrew Quigley, and he'll be here next Friday evening, and he speaks with an Irish accent, but he's a pastor in Scotland now, and he'll be the man who'll be hosting us in Scotland. I want you to get to know him before we get over there. I want him to get to know you. And there are about how many signed up at this point, Heather?
32 from here, and I guess some are full over there, so almost 60.
There'll be 60-some people at that conference, 30-some from here. Let's bow our hearts in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you now for this time together as we look at that organization which you yourself describe as being your bride. Lord, we're grieved at that time when we see spots and blemishes in your bride. God forbid that we should look back through the years and point our fingers at the spots and blemishes in your bride there and fail to see the spots and blemishes right here and in the church today. God, bless us as we would learn how it is that you cleaned out some of those spots and smoothed out some of those wrinkles, and how you still have as your purpose to present this church to yourself as a sacrifice, spotless and without blemish. Lord, would you please use us in cleaning out the spots and smoothing out the wrinkles in your church today. And we'll spend eternity thanking you and praising you for just using us in presenting this church to yourself as a sacrifice, spotless and without blemish. In Jesus' name we pray it. Amen. Would you please pray for Charles Ware's son, a teenager, who Dr. Ware over here at the Baptist Bible College, many of you know him, And I think he's 17, maybe. But the reports are in conflict right now as to what happened. But apparently there's one or two vertebrae that was broken. And he is paralyzed down here at Riley Hospital tonight. And as far as we can tell, he'll look forward to being paralyzed for the remainder of his life.
His name is Matt.
Matthew, yes. And any more word on that, Brad?
The most recent thing I heard was last night from the vice president of the Baptist Bible College. And it didn't sound good.
Charles, Dr. Ware was out in Washington State when he got the word last night. But pray for a father as he comes back to be with his son under these circumstances, for a family, and for a healing. I just finished calling Dr. Heimberger. Bob had been used by the Surgeon General in Vietnam for many, many years because so many of the boys were stepping on landmines, and Bob had found some amazing things. When treatment can be caught within the first 48 hours of the damage, then there are ways of bringing about some healing to that. And Bob would know what those were, and I'm sure that they're doing the kinds of things that Bob would do if he himself were practicing medicine down at Riley. They're doing those things today, I'm sure. But I just called Bob, and I don't know whether there'd be something else that could be suggested or not. But please pray for the father and mother. He's a godly man. He's preached here many times, and he has strong Reformed faith. You're excused. Thank you.